headlines, Iran's top security official says no deal will ever stop the country from maintaining and developing its peaceful nuclear achievements. The Pentagon deploys to Germany the first batch of soldiers meant to reinforce NATO forces against a possible conflict with Russia over Ukraine. Plus, China advising the U.S. to be more flexible towards North Korea as it votes down Washington's proposed statement against Pyongyang's missile launches at the Security Council.
Hello and welcome to your world news, coming to you live from our headquarters in Tehran. My name is Gisum Shahmadi.
Iran's top security official says his country has the legal right to continue developing peaceful nuclear capabilities and achievements. In a tweet, Ali Shamkhani says no agreement can deny Iran its right to research and development, as well as the security to deter evil acts. His comments come as Iran and the remaining parties to the 2015 deal are engaged in talks in Vienna to revive the accord. The deal was put in limbo after the U.S. left it in 2018 and reimposed sanctions on Iran. On Friday, Washington restored a number of sanctions waivers, saying that the step is meant to facilitate the Vienna talks. The exemptions allow foreign companies to resume cooperation with Iran on its nuclear projects. Iran has time and again said the Vienna talks should result in the full removal of sanctions. Now, Tehran-based political analyst Mustafa Khoshchishm joined us with his take on the U.S. agenda behind this move to restore a number of sanctions waivers. Let's take a listen.
This U.S. waiver is not worth even a penny. It's a deceitful measure because the Americans, first of all, would like to continue this playing game. This is part of the U.S. playing game strategy. They mean to take to show this goodwill gesture to the world and to the Iranians that we've taken the first step, while this is not the case at all. What Iran has been requesting is a removal of economic sanctions. And the nuclear issue and nuclear undertakings and all issues pertaining to Iran's nuclear undertakings have been a demand by the U.S. and its European allies and not Iran. In fact, the Americans would like very much to shift the discussions and negotiations towards nuclear issues. And this has been a step in that regard in order to prioritize nuclear issues, to shift the negotiations to their own demand rather than discussions, concentrating and focusing negotiations on the removal of economic sanctions.
Iraq's Sadrist movement, led by top Shia cleric Muqtada al-Sadr, has boycotted talks with other political factions about the establishment of a future government. Hassan al-Azari, a senior official of the movement, says its representatives will not take part in a parliamentary session slated for Monday. No reason has been mentioned for the decision. Iraqi Prime Minister Mustafa al-Kadhimi reacted to this announcement. He said that no matter how serious political divisions are, there should be no differences of opinion about fundamentals of establishing a government. Kadhimi said all political groups should prioritize the national interests and act accordingly. Iraq's new parliament held its first session on January 9th, following elections in October last year. And the United States begins deploying additional troops to Europe for what it calls reinforcing NATO allies amid a standoff with Russia over Ukraine. The U.S. military says the first batch of troops has already arrived in Germany. The military says they will set up a headquarters there to support the paratroopers meant to deploy to Poland. Poland and Romania are the two countries which U.S. President Joe Biden has ordered nearly 3,000 extra troops to. Washington says the move aims to shield Eastern Europe in face of a potential spillover from the Ukraine crisis. The U.S. and its allies accuse Russia of preparing to attack Ukraine. Moscow denies that and is strongly opposed to increasing military activity by the U.S. and NATO near its borders. Now, tensions remain high between Russia and the West over Ukraine, despite talks held in previous weeks to defuse them. The U.S. and its NATO allies insist that Russia plans to invade Ukraine and is providing pretexts for that. Russia denies any such plan and instead complains about increased military activity by NATO near its borders. Even Ukraine has called on the West not to create panic. So, why is the West keeping its stance? Let's take a look at this report.
Eastern Europe has once again turned into a tinderbox in recent weeks amid a war of words between the United States and its allies on the one side and Russia on the other. The West is accusing Moscow of planning to attack its western neighbor Ukraine, citing thousands of Russian troops stationed along Russia's western borders. The Kremlin, however, has strongly denied the allegation, saying it has deployed the troops as a means of self-defense in the face of NATO's eastward expansion. Even Ukraine, a US ally, agrees with Russia on this. Ukrainian Defense Minister Oleksiy Reznikov has downplayed the threat of an all-out war in Ukraine, blaming the rising tensions on the international media. Also, President Volodymyr Zelensky has called on the West to stop stirring up tensions, arguing that warnings of an imminent invasion are putting Ukraine's economy at risk. Regardless, the US continues to fan the flames of tensions. Washington is now claiming it has information suggesting Moscow will conduct a false flag attack to justify its invasion of Ukraine, but it did not provide any information to back the intelligence findings.
The U.S. captured huge pieces of territory by beating up on Spain, and they used a false flag there, Gulf of Tonkin in Vietnam. The incubator babies in 1990 was enabled the first war in Iraq. The WMDs, the invisible WMDs in Iraq in 2003. In Libya, the invisible airplanes, apparently Russian satellites just couldn't see them, that were supposedly strafing protesters, that, by the way, no one had any video of in Benghazi and Tripoli, that enabled the bombing and destruction of Libya and the murder of Muammar Gaddafi. The U.S. does this all the time. Russia, there's no example of that you can point to, although the State Department spokesperson Ned Price yesterday acted as if there was a long tradition of these actions by the Russians. And so what the U.S. is doing, the simple, short answer to this is it's called misdirection. Or projection as a psychiatric term that they use.
It's not the first time the U.S. is making such accusations. Last month, U.S. officials said Russia was preparing to fabricate a pretext for a large-scale operation in Ukraine, an accusation that Moscow slammed as unfounded.
Since taking office in January last year, the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden has extended pressure on Russia and China. It has imposed rounds of sanctions on both countries over various issues. The result? The two Eastern superpowers are inching closer. They've promised to boost cooperation, including on plans to use their national currencies in trade instead of using the U.S. dollar.
China and Russia are strengthening their ties. That's the key takeaway from the meeting between Russian President Vladimir Putin and his Chinese counterpart Xi Jinping. It was the first in-person meeting the Chinese president has had with another head of state in about 2 years. Meeting on the sidelines of the Beijing Winter Olympics, the two leaders, in a show of solidarity, stressed that their strategic cooperation was unshakable, warning the West to stop its eastward expansion. The Kremlin said Putin and Xi discussed the need to broaden bilateral trade in national currencies due to unpredictability surrounding the use of the dollar. The announcement comes after US President Joe Biden's threat that Russian companies could be cut off from the ability to trade in dollars as part of sweeping sanctions in the event of Russia's invasion of Ukraine. Describing the meeting as warm and substantive, the Kremlin hailed the relationship between the two major powers as an advanced partnership with a special character.
But if China decides that their reciprocal sanctions are going to include we're not selling you any more stuff, then Americans won't have televisions, cars, toasters, refrigerators, all kinds of other things. So the U.S. has been using this as a weapon But the image I have in my mind as I watch things unfold is of a person that's painting the floor all around them until they end up in the corner by themselves and the rest of the floor wet. They're stuck in the corner.
In a lengthy joint statement, they opposed NATO expansion and accused the U.S. of stoking instability in the region. The two sides also decried the military alliance's Cold War approach to international affairs. For years, the former Soviet Union and the United States were locked in geopolitical tensions dubbed the Cold War that risked escalating into an all-out war between the two nuclear superpowers. Times have changed since then. The next Cold War could drag on for much longer and prove devastating to all aspects of life on Earth.
Moving on. China is urging more flexibility from the United States to reduce tensions with North Korea over its nuclear and ballistic missile program.
The key in solving this issue is already in the hands of the United States. U.S. is a direct party to the Korean Peninsula issue. If they do want to see some new breakthrough, they should show more sincerity and flexibility.
The Chinese envoy says the U.S. should come up with more attractive and practical actions that address North Korea's concerns. Zhang warns Washington to avoid what he calls a vicious circle of confrontation, condemnation, and sanctions against Pyongyang. His comments came ahead of a closed-door U.N. Security Council meeting on North Korea's latest ballistic missile tests. At that meeting, the U.S. put forward a joint statement condemning Pyongyang's test firing, but seven members refused to sign it. Meanwhile, the U.S. ambassador to the U.N. says Washington is ready to sit down for talks with Pyongyang without preconditions. Now, Toronto becomes the second Canadian city where truckers line the streets to push for an end to mandated COVID vaccines. Dozens of tractors and pickup trucks roll into Toronto's downtown on Friday afternoon. They plan to hold a protest at the weekend against mandatory COVID vaccines for cross-border truckers. Some are angry at the entire restrictions the government has enforced to fight the virus. They say Prime Minister Justin Trudeau has exceeded his authority and should leave power. The truckers in Toronto are part of a convoy called Freedom Convoy, which has already reached the capital, Ottawa. Protesters there have shut down the center of the city for more than a week now. Ottawa police have promised to crack down on what they call an increasingly dangerous protest there. Also, the COVID-19 pandemic keeps taking its toll on the United States, with overall fatalities now surpassing 900,000. According to the Johns Hopkins University, over 100,000 fatalities were just added since mid-December. Data shows new daily deaths are still rising, with an average of 2,400. The new wave of rising COVID cases is also taking place, with at least 18 states and Puerto Rico setting pandemic records for a second day. Health experts are now warning Americans about what they call an Omicron blizzard in the coming weeks. They say rising infections threaten hospitals, schools, and other sectors and could heavily impact daily lives. The U.S. has the largest death and case tallies in the world. And British households have been hit by the news of higher energy bills, interest rates, and inflation. The government is trying to downplay its role in making Britain significantly poorer, but the opposition is having none of that. Bianca Rahimi reports from London.
Come April, many Britons will have to choose between heating and eating. Everything from bus fares to mortgages are going to cost more. Interest rates have gone up twice in 7 weeks, and three more hikes are on the horizon as the central bank tries to tackle the situation. The opposition members of parliament are livid, saying the government is incompetent.
He doesn't like it, Mr. Speaker. When children in my constituency go to bed with no food in their tummies, with no heat in their homes, what does he really think is the honourable position of a Chancellor who has just allowed one of his policies directly to be taken in fraud, £4.3 billion of fraud under his watch? Any other Chancellor that I've known would come to the House today to resign.
This week, millions learnt that their gas and electricity bills are going to jump 54%. The government says there's nothing it can do with energy prices going up worldwide.
I don't believe them at all. You know, I'm sure they know. You know, and this is just to put people more in poverty. You know, and it's not right. It's not fair. You know, people working very hard.
When you look at the price of things now, everything going up higher than it was. And that's why so many people on the street, living on the street, because they can't afford to eat or drink.
Oh, I feel like it's government responsible to support people who are in this horrible situation. Because I had a problem this year myself. I couldn't find an apartment because the prices went up crazy twice.
Also causing inflation to rise is supply chain issues, higher import taxes and wages increasing. Brexit, the pandemic and a global energy crisis, a perfect storm for Britain, now in the grips of its worst economic slump in 300 years. But who will have to pay for it all?
On April 1st, the cost of living will be going up £3,000 a year for each household. On the very same day, British politicians will be getting a £2,000 a year pay rise. From this, it is clear that those that are on top of the pile have their bills covered, and it's those on the breadline that will be picking up those bills. Bianca Rahimi from London.
And now with that, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Selection of Ayatollah Khamenei's viewpoints.
Hame ba wujood ghudde saratani Israel mukhalifin.
All of us are opposed to the cancer's tumor, Israel.
Wajh mushtarak hame wahdat ummat islami.
Unity of Islamic Ummah is the aspect that all of Islamic denominations have in common.
January 5th, 2022.
The January 9th uprising was a brilliant combination of zeal and rationality. The event of January 9th was an example. The event of January 9th in the year 1978 was the same. At that time too, there was a big threat that lasted several months, but the people's zeal brought them into the arena on the 9th of January and put an end to the threat and any ill effects it may have had. their zeal turned that threat into an opportunity. So one point is that the religious zeal of the people had been the main factor in these achievements and in turning threats into opportunities. This should be preserved. Speakers, writers, and those who can influence the people's thinking should pay attention to this point. Of course, it is evident that the opponents and enemies will be busy in this regard. They will question the statements that I have made today, but the truth is this. The truth is that religious zeal should be preserved in the people, and by God's grace it will be preserved.
دنیای اسلام یک نسخه امروز دارد و اون اتحاد.
The world of Islam has one single prescription today, and that is unity. This prescription exists in all Islamic countries. Nations should be united.
The second point I wish to raise is that you must pay attention to the fact that one of the things that is very serious in the plots formulated by the enemies of the religious and Islamic Republic is their plan to eliminate sensitivity about the principles and foundations of the revolution. The people are sensitive about the fundamental principles of the revolution, and they refute those who question these principles. However, the enemies wish to gradually undermine this sensitivity. They are attempting to do this using the vast propaganda that is being spread through the internet and in the foreign media in one way or another. Sometimes they highlight and magnify the viewpoints of people who are not of much value, neither their comments nor their ideas. There are some people who have a limited intellectual capacity, and they make extravagant claims and question the principles and foundations of the revolution. One important principle of the revolution is the authority of religion. The Islamic Republic and the Islamic Revolution was essentially established for the sake of the authority of God's religion. They were established to help society have a religious form and a religious geometry. They were established to help the government take on a religious geometry and to move forward accordingly. This was one of the clear principles of the revolution. The people laid down their lives and offered their blood for this to come about. This authority of religion is one of the principles of the religion, but they are undermining this.
Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. Indeed, you gave me hope. Oh, Allah, I want to thank you. I want to thank you for all the things that you've done. You've done for me through all my years. I've been lost. You guided me from all the ways that were wrong. I want to thank you for bringing me home.
Africa Today.
Several African countries have been forced to discard millions of doses of COVID-19 vaccines donated or actually dumped by major Western powers because the vaccines expired within weeks of being received as donations. Last December, Nigeria had no option but to destroy more than 1 million doses of expired AstraZeneca vaccines. A senior official speaks here on the expired vaccines. Let's take a listen.
In an environment where despite the interest, despite concerted effort by the federal government to procure these vaccines were not available in the open market a few months ago because they had largely been mopped up by the wealthier nations.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and as always, it's always great welcoming you here at Africa Today, our weekly program that gives you an alternative view of events making headlines in Africa. In the first segment of our program, we are focusing on how Western countries stockpile excess vaccines and donate them to African countries when they are about to expire. In the second part of our program, we shall talk about Djibouti, a tiny but strategic Horn of Africa state that has been turned into a hub of imperialist powers seeking to spread the hegemony all over Africa and beyond. Stay with us until the end of our show.
Expired COVID-19 vaccines in Africa. Several African countries, including Nigeria, Uganda, and Malawi, have been forced to destroy millions of doses of expired COVID-19 vaccines that were donated by Western countries. This scandal comes at a time when many countries on the African continent are facing vaccine nationalism and apartheid from the West.
And in response to this dumping of expired vaccines, Dr. John Nkenga Song, director of Africa Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, recently called for donated COVID-19 vaccines to come with a shelf life of 3 to 6 months. He says this will enable countries plan their rollouts and avoid a situation where doses expire. He noted that African countries are now refusing donated vaccines that are about to expire.
Some certain countries are actually refusing totally to accept the vaccines because of exactly that. If they see that the shelf life that of the given vaccine is only 1 month or 2 months, they prefer not to receive those vaccines because it will create a narrative that vaccines have expired in their countries. I think most countries are very sensitive to that now.
Now, to discuss this dumping of vaccines in Africa by Western countries, we contacted Dr. Catherine Chabutungi, an epidemiologist and the executive director of African Population and Health Research Center. Thanks a lot, madam, for your time.
Thank you for having me.
Now, several African countries have been forced to discard millions of doses of COVID-19 vaccines donated by major Western powers because they expired within weeks of being received as donations. Now, what's your take on this?
The African systems for delivering the COVID vaccine have not evolved, you know, in the last 12 months, if I could say, from early 2021. The systems have not evolved because supply has been erratic, it has been unpredictable, and so it is inevitable that when you have millions of doses being dumped on the continent in the last 2 months of the year, you know, that it is inevitable that those doses cannot be absorbed in the time frame they're supposed to be absorbed in. If these were doses which perhaps are going to expire after 7 months or after 9 months, that wouldn't be a problem. But dumping millions of doses on a system which has not been set up to absorb those doses at the time of the year when there's so much disruption because of the Christmas break, I think it was inevitable. That's what I would say, and that's what I said, that it was inevitable. And it's such a shame that we are in a situation where few doses of vaccines are being wasted just because of the way the whole global supply system is set up.
This dumping of about-to-expire vaccines is regrettable, especially as Africa remains the least vaccinated continent against COVID-19. The move to dump vaccines in Africa is not only immoral, but also a violation of basic human rights. Experts say such behavior by the West is the weakest link in the fight against COVID-19. In a bid to stop this dumping, Kenya now says it will not accept vaccines with a shelf life of below 3 months.
We will not accept any donation whose expiry is less than 90 days. We are ideally looking for 120 days, which is 4 months, but will not accept anything below 90 days.
Why are Western countries engaging in what is clearly political showmanship of donating vaccines which are about to expire?
Western countries have already done that. It's just that COVID-19 is in the public eye because there's so much media coverage and everybody's invested in understanding what is going on in a system that has always existed that way. So I think to look at this, you have to put yourself in the shoes of Western countries, that if you're a Western country leader, you're a politician,
The COVID-19 vaccine procurement facility led by the African Vaccine Procurement Trust, the African Center for Diseases Control and Prevention, and the WHO are calling for improvements in the quality of vaccines donated to Africa. Now, Dr. Chuktungi, how can these be achieved?
Now, what should be done to change course? Going back to my earlier point, I think we have to think about the long-term things, the medium-term things, and the short-term things. Now, the long-term, of course, is the, you know, how do we shift this whole broken system of global health where there's such power imbalance, there's such, overwhelming influence by some countries over global health practice. And then what you call putting profits before people. Those are political choices that the residents and the populations in those Western countries have to make, where, for instance, they could, you know, make political choices that favor politicians and governments and parties that put humanity above, you know, profit. That's a much more long-term thing because it has to happen in more countries and, so that at least at the end of the day, the world, you know, has a sort of a reset of its values.
Now, South African President Cyril Ramaphosa says in order to tackle the current situation, developing countries need to manufacture their own vaccines. He made the remarks in January when he opened a new vaccine plant in Cape Town. Let's take a listen.
Africa should no longer go cap in hand to the Western world begging and begging for vaccines that they just want to drip off from their tables. We will stand on our own.
Dr. Chuktungi, now what are the obstacles towards the manufacture of vaccines in Africa?
And yet the benefit extends beyond the individual. So vaccines traditionally have been funded or financed as public goods, where globally there have been mechanisms which have been put in place to ensure that everybody everywhere can receive vaccines without having to think about the cost of those vaccines. And so when you have this kind of mechanism, it is not profitable for pharmaceutical companies to produce vaccines, because if they produce them and they went to market them and sell them the way they sell everything else, the market wouldn't exist. And so the system has been set up in such a way that vaccines being global public goods, they are financed in a very specific model. And therefore, Africa, without having already existing infrastructure before these funding models are put in place, wouldn't be competitive on the global market for producing vaccines and selling them. So there have been no prior investments in mass manufacture vaccines in Africa. But what the pandemic has shown us is that Africa is dispensable. African lives are dispensable. When push comes to shove, when every country is facing a pandemic, an outbreak within their borders, they'll prioritize their citizens. And so Africa, which has traditionally not had capacity, is the last on the list of priorities.
Iran is now a major manufacturer of COVID-19 vaccines. The Islamic Republic has developed vaccines such as Coviran Barakat and Pastu Covac, which are now being used in the country's national vaccination drive. The Pastu Covac vaccine has been successfully produced jointly by Iran and Cuba. Iran has expressed readiness to share its vaccine technology with other African and developing countries, which will certainly lead to self-sufficiency in vaccine production.
Historically, we know about some Western pharmaceutical companies such as Pfizer that used Africa to undertake illegal or unethical trial of drugs. Some African countries participated in the COVID-19 vaccine trials, but unfortunately, they were not prioritized in the on-time distribution of vaccines. Now, Dr. Chuktungi, what is being done to decolonize the global health system?
The environment has improved, and the regulatory environment has improved for research. And so the narrative around guinea pigs, once in a while you get the occasional unethical practice, but it's not as prevalent as it was a few years ago. Now, having said that, I think the question is, based on what we know and our experience, for instance, with HIV/AIDS therapeutics, what kind of negotiations the countries which had vaccine trials happening within their borders, what kind of negotiations they had, and whether there was any special considerations to be sure that they get a certain allocation of vaccine doses once the trials were concluded. I'm not privy to that. And by all indications, those countries don't seem to be advantaged compared to other countries. And so it's possible that in spite of all the investment in strengthening the system, that still this was something that countries missed out in when they were negotiating or when they were accepting to have their populations participate in these vaccine trials.
We are apparently short of time, but thanks a lot, Dr. Catherine Chumtungi, for your insight. We now take a short break, and when we come back, we shall see how Djibouti has become a hub of imperialist aggression in Africa. Stay with us. Djibouti is a tiny Horn of Africa country located at the Strait of Bab el-Mandeb, which links the Red Sea to the Gulf of Aden. Now, this country is considered of vital strategic importance, but despite its location, Djibouti remains poor and is now being used as a hub of United States-led imperialist powers that seek to spread their hegemony in Africa and beyond.
Successive regimes in Djibouti have clung to power by promoting their small country in the Horn of Africa as a vital tool for Western powers to use in the quest for their global dominance. While neo-colonial Western powers use Djibouti only as a military base, the country is benefiting from China's Belt and Road Initiative, a global infrastructure development strategy. The US is now intent on misusing its presence in Djibouti to counter China, which established a military base in the country to safeguard world peace and development.
When I visited China for training in 2009-2010, there was a very big change because all areas of the military had been computerized, and you had the advanced technologies in terms of satellite, in terms of computers, in terms of nuclear forces, which are purely defensive.
For analysis on how Djibouti is being misused by Western powers as a center of imperialist aggression, we contacted Abdurrahman Muhammad Ahmed, a Djiboutian political activist living in exile. Thanks a lot for your time, sir.
Thank you.
Now, how did Djibouti turn into a major base of U.S. militarization and imperialism in Africa?
We can say that actually the decision was not an idea that came from Djibouti or the political leaders of Djibouti at that moment, but it was always a long vision from the U.S. and especially the Western imperialist camp to have this idea of controlling major maritime road. So after the September 11, there has been a negotiation, and we know with fact today that that discussion was facilitated by another vassal regime of U.S. imperialism, namely the Emirates, under the guise of actually helping Djibouti to develop its economy. So after September 11, that's when the U.S. decided to have a military base in Djibouti.
Last November, Djibouti hosted the U.S.-led Allied Appreciation Day, in which major U.S. allies, including Britain and France, showcased a variety of equipment that is part of their military operation. Military officials presented a variety of military capabilities and a military flyover. What was the motivation of Djibouti in approving such an event that could be viewed as a threat to China, which has a base in the country?
Djibouti became actually lost its sovereignty, so they accept silently any dictate for other benefits, such as actually kind of money, or actually by keeping that dictatorial regime in the loop of the Western countries. But for me, when they showcased their equipment, it was a message directed first of all to the rest of the African country, because today we know that they are losing their credibility, or what's left about their credibility. So they are still trying to say, we still have the best equipment and we are the best to defend you, which is not true.
By allowing aggressive military moves by Western armies on its soil, Djibouti could be turning itself into a power keg.
In 2018, there were military tensions between the United States and China in Djibouti. Now, in a provocative move, Pentagon claimed the Chinese lasers injured U.S. military pilots in Djibouti. China refuted the allegations, saying it was in complete contradiction to the facts.
I can tell you the Chinese side, having conducted serious checks, has already clearly told the U.S. side that their so-called criticisms totally do not accord with the facts.
Now, Mr. Ahmad, is there a likelihood of a military confrontation between China and the United States in Djibouti?
Yes, the possibility is very high. And already what we are witnessing is actually a kind of a Cold War confrontation. On another side, they're trying to actually tarnish the image of China, especially when it comes to Djibouti, because China actually facilitated a lot of infrastructure projects, building the People Palace, building hospital, schools, stadium, roads.
The current Djibouti president, Ismail Omar Guelleh, has been in power for 22 years. April last year, he was re-elected for a fifth term as president with more than 98% of the vote after the election in a tiny country was boycotted by the main opposition. A citizen who spoke on the condition of anonymity for fear of reprisal by the country's dictatorship gives his reasons for not voting. During the elections, Guelleh faced just one challenger, political newcomer Zakaria Ismail Farah. This sole opposition candidate cast doubt on the transparency of the voting process, saying his delegates were ejected from polling stations. The US and other Western countries claim to advocate for democracy in the other African countries, but have ignored the dictatorship in Djibouti. This is another clear case of double standards.
Former president was more close to let's say the Western imperialism, and when he left power in 1999, he made sure that his nephew, the actual president, came to power. The actual president was at that moment not a political figure, but he made sure through a kind of a political coup to come to power, and since then, since 1999 up to today, it's more than actually 23 years, Ismail Omar Guelleh is still in power, and the Western allies are very happy with him and with his regime, because he's playing a crucial role for their interests, not only in Djibouti but also in the region, and very specifically when it comes to Somalia.
Despite hosting Western military bases for decades, Djibouti is near the very bottom of the annual United Nations Human Development Index, ranking 166 out of 189. Now, Mr. Ahmad, what is the reason for this high level of poverty in Djibouti?
This past 44 years of independence, Djibouti today is worse than what, when we get the independence. And the reason is actually, when it comes to imperialism, what they want is actually always to put in place a puppet regime, a stooge regime that will keep or protect their interests, and only these few people will get short benefits, while the majority of the people will get rip off from the their land. And their own opportunities. So yes, I'm not surprised, and actually this is what's going on.
Can you elaborate a little bit on why these imperialist powers are interested in seeing poverty and destitution in Djibouti?
The imperialistic vision, it's actually to control physically and military, to control all these strategic location and not allow actually any awakening from the people. And we know also that actually people who are living there are Muslim, so they don't want actually any Muslim countries cooperating, defending their interests, coming back and developing their people, who even might become an example for other countries and other people. And what's happening in Djibouti, it is the perfect study case for many people, specifically for the Muslim community, because and thank you for this opportunity of especially this discussion with Press TV, because today when it comes to Djibouti or Somalia or other Muslim country, Iran, the Islamic Republic of Iran, is demonized by the imperialist camp. But we know actually from our side that the Iranian people actually stood, refused to actually to be subjugated and actually developed their country. But they don't want us to follow that example. They don't want us actually to tell that story. They're telling us a propaganda.
Well, thank you very much, Abdulrahman Muhammad Ahmad. It was a very interesting discussion, but unfortunately, our time is up for today. We shall definitely revisit this subject in future. Well, that's it for this week's edition of Africa Today. And until our next episode, it's goodbye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website www.parstoday.com/en.
Be aware, the hearts find rest in Allah's remembrance.
Spring of truth.
Allahu ya Allah subhanallah. Allahu ya Allah walhamdulillah. Allahu wa la ilaha illallah. Allahu ya Allah.
Islam has set you free. Islam has declared men and women free. All are free. April 6, 1979. Today you are free. All the brothers and sisters are today free. Free to criticize the government, free to criticize anything that goes against the path of the nation and Islam. Free to make fundamental demands of the government. This movement has made you free, has liberated you from the bonds which bound the nation.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Today we are with another program of Spring of Truth from IRB English Radio. And I'm your host, Sayyid Mohsen Naqvi, with the viewpoints of Imam Khomeini in regards to the Islamic Revolution. In one of his speeches, Imam Khomeini has said that know that a revolution as good as the revolution of Iran had not taken place before. Now, this is a big claim if we look at this part of speech where he says, like, know that a revolution as good as the revolution of Iran had not taken place before. It's a big thing. Why Imam has said that no revolution was taken place as good as this revolution? The reason is that this revolution is taking people towards the perfection. All the other revolutions that we have seen in the world, they were done, and at the time of revolution, everyone was involved in that revolution, but slowly and by the passage of time, this revolution has lost its importance. With the passage of time, it lost its importance in the eyes of people and in the eyes of those who brought this revolution. This Islamic revolution, even after 40 years, we see that the leader and most of the people are saying that we are revolutionary, where the Persian phrase is used is that inqilabiyam, which means that I am a revolutionary. And this slogan is amongst the people and people are following this slogan. Therefore, anything that they do in the political section, in the economical section, in the medical, in the sciences, in the advancements of the technology, they all are working as a revolutionary person. And therefore, we can see different titles. For example, the revolutionary economics, which has been said by the supreme leader of Iran. Therefore, everything that we see here is perfect, obviously, because they are after perfection. Therefore, they are following the footsteps of the real Islam. And this lacks in other revolutions. In the history, we see many revolutions, but they lack this aspect of being revolutionary in them. And therefore, Imam Khomeini knew it, and that's why he said that this revolution is the best revolution which has been taken place, and there was none before it.
Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Every night and every day, never forget to say, La ilaha
miles.
And can you imagine a world where there is no fear? A world of trust, of peace, and of love. Well, 2 years ago, I went out on a journey where I wanted to create such a world.
My name is Christina Paltén. I'm 48 years old. In Gustavsberg, which is east of Stockholm.
I used to work at Ericsson, and I was employed there for 18 years. I was working with supply of software. But, it was fun to be an engineer for a while. But after a while, I realized that it's maybe not what I want to do. I had discovered how fun it is to run. My feeling for running is I love it. It means freedom, physical and mental good health. It means strength. It means discovering beautiful nature, going to places, and to be a part of nature. It makes me feel alive. But as my running increased, I wanted to do something different, and I wanted to do something that I believe in.
But at the age of 31, a friend of mine, she gave me a call asking, Christina, do you want to run a 10-kilometer long race with me?
At first I thought, that's a very long distance. But it was challenging and it sounded fun, so I decided to do it. And I did manage, and I really loved it. And since then I've been doing longer and longer races. I did half marathon, then a full marathon. And then finally a friend of mine we bought a ticket. We flew to Istanbul. Me and Karina, we have been running from Turkey to Finland and then kayak from Finland to Stockholm. And actually we did kayak in this water, as we are seeing now.
And I thought, whoa, you did great. And 11 years after my first race, so I got a grip on myself, and here I am on that treadmill, and I passed the old world record more than 2 hours ago. And there's hundreds of people in the gym, and I see joy in their eyes. I feel warmth.
I did set the world record on 48-hour running on a treadmill. So this is the certificate from Guinness World of Records that stating that I'm a world record holder. But my thoughts went to that I wanted to do more adventures. And then I was thinking, what about if I take a flight ticket back to Istanbul and then I go running through Turkey, through Iran, and then continue and do a lap around the world? But I thought that would be a pretty long time and a long run. I became interested in Iran when I was planning that trip. And then I thought, why not just go only Iran? Because I heard it's a very beautiful country. And I also heard that it's a lot of friendly people and also very nice food there, and I need a lot of food when running. Okay. In the beginning, a friend of mine, she was very worried. Actually, she